And what we found was that there are a number of different ways in which alcohol and cannabis are related to these cognitive variables or cognitive functions. So first and foremost, substance use risk and low cognitive functioning are highly correlated and likely reflect some kind of underlying common vulnerability.
That's Dr. Patricia Conrad from the University of Montreal, who will be joining us later in the podcast to talk about the relationship between adolescent substance use and cognitive development. Her work appears in the February 2019 issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. But first, we'll hear from Dr. Kathleen Brady. Dr. Brady is a new deputy editor of the journal, and she will be speaking about articles in the February issue that help improve our understanding of substance use disorders. I'm Michael Roy, executive editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry, and this is AJP Audio. First, our interview with Dr. Kathleen Brady. At the start of this year, Dr. Brady joined the journal as a deputy editor. She's vice president for research at the Medical University of South Carolina, and she's a prominent leader in the field of substance abuse at a national and international level. Dr. Brady is known for her research in the areas of drug and alcohol dependence, post-traumatic stress disorder, and medication development. Hi, Dr. Brady, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Happy to have you. And first, congratulations on joining the editorial leadership team of the American Journal of Psychiatry.
I am very excited about this position. I really look forward to working with the team.
Now, as part of that work, you've written an editorial for our February issue titled Improving Our Understanding of Substance Use Disorders, and it highlights the several articles on this topic appearing in the issue. What are some of the key points that readers can take away from this new research?
Well, there's a few things I think that are really remarkable about the research that you'll find in the February issue. There's a number of studies that are dealing with imaging techniques and new imaging techniques to really help us better understand the brain mechanisms that underlie addiction. And in particular, one article looking at the connectome, or basically looking at the way various parts of the brain connect with each other in people who have addictions versus those who don't. And it really demonstrated that, you know, if you've got good control between executive function and some of your more impulsive areas of the brain, that you had a better chance of not relapsing to substance use. So, and that really, I think, gives us some targets for the development of new therapeutics, both pharmacotherapy, but also really helps us with the development of our behavioral therapies and cognitive therapies targeting addiction. So I thought that article was particularly interesting. In addition, there were a couple of articles that dealt with adolescent substance use disorder, which is just such a critical issue. In particular, we've known for a long time that early childhood adversity and childhood abuse is associated with the development of substance use disorders. In fact, very closely associated with that. That's one of the strongest links with early adversity is with substance use. Not, you know, it's associated with depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, all kinds of other psychopathology, but the strongest link is with the development of substance use disorder. So we've known this from epidemiologic and surveys of treatment-seeking individuals, but the mechanism underlying it has always been a mystery. And until you really understand the mechanistic connections, it's hard to develop either therapeutic or preventative measures. And in this study, they actually looked at some of the genetic and epigenetic changes that had happened in adolescents with early childhood adversity who developed substance use disorders, and really, I think, have added a lot to our understanding of the biologic mechanisms underlying the impact of stress on the development of substance use disorders. The other article I thought was particularly interesting, also dealing with adolescence, was a study that compared cognitive changes in kids that were smoking marijuana versus those that weren't over a four-year period, and showed us that cannabis use, not alcohol use, demonstrated effects on inhibitory control, working and delayed memory recall, and perceptual reasoning. Now, I think we've always suspected that cannabis use in adolescents could be particularly damaging, especially when you think about all of the hard work that needs to happen during adolescence in order for people to mature into healthy adults, all the learning that needs to go on, all the achievement in school and that sort of thing that really predicts how well people will do as adults. And so I found this particularly compelling in this age where, in the United States in particular, and actually all around the world, we're dealing with what could be some fallout from the recreational use of marijuana and how we control that, and that it's really important. This kind of finding is really important to drive public health initiatives in a time when we've really got changing policies around marijuana use.
Indeed. And when we published that study, I mean, that it definitely got a lot of attention when we published it online. And so we are going to be talking with the authors of that study later on in that podcast, and later on in this podcast. And I was drawn by what you're talking about with terms of the research, with the links and connections that are starting to be developed. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the significance of substance use disorders in the context of mental health care.
Yes. Well, you know, for so long, substance use has been sort of the red-haired stepchild of mental health disorders. In fact, when I started in this field, which was a long time ago, 30-plus years ago, you didn't really address substance use we didn't learn much about it in residency, and you didn't necessarily address it in your patients who had depression, who had anxiety, who had schizophrenia. And as it turns out, you know, substance use is common in the general population, probably, you know, about 1 in 10 to 1 in 20 at some point in their lives have a problem with it. But it's 2 to 3 times more common in individuals who have psychiatric disorders. So psychiatric disorders predispose people to use substances. Using substances probably leads to unmasking a vulnerability to a psychiatric disorder, and you really can't treat one without at least acknowledging and being aware of the other. In other words, you're treating somebody with an anxiety disorder, you need to be aware of what their drinking patterns are, if they're using stimulants. All that stuff could be very important in both the treatment and prognosis for treatment for their disease. So substance use disorders are really intimately entwined with psychiatric disorders. And I think over the last, you know, 10 to 20 years, that realization has become much more broadly accepted. And I think that's going to be to the benefit of all of our patients.
Indeed. And now you've discussed the substance abuse research that we're publishing in our February issue. I was wondering if you could take a moment to go beyond what we're currently publishing and describe what areas of substance use research are you hoping to see undertaken, and to take it a step further with your role with us in the journal, potentially appear in the journal.
Yes. Well, I want to see continuation of some of the types of work that's going to be published in the February journal. There were several very interesting imaging articles, and the more we know about brain function in individuals with addictions, the more we can tailor and target our treatments. I also think that there's no area in medicine where I can think of epigenetics, and we know there's genetic influences in the development of addictions, but epigenetic changes are incredibly important in addictions. I mean, these are really epigenetic triggers, the substances of use themselves. And so I truly think more investigation in the genetic and epigenetic area is going to help us tremendously in really developing a more personalized medicine approach to the treatment of addictions. We have a handful of medications. As with many other psychiatric disorders, we have variability in response, a fairly large variability in response. And some of that surely can be predicted by people's genetic and epigenetic profile. So I hope to see more studies in those areas of genetics and epigenetics that will help us to drive personalized medicine in the area of addictions. And then finally, what we have really, as we look at the opioid epidemic, we have a public health crisis in the opioid epidemic. And when we have public health crisis, I think we really need to respond with a multimodal response that really addresses the population at large. And I also think that it's going to be ever more important to really integrate the treatment of addictions into primary care. So I'd love to see on the real practical and maybe larger scale studies that look at integrating the treatment of addictions into primary care settings and really some of these population health approaches to the treatment of addiction, some real systems level approaches.
Well, yeah, there's definitely certainly more to do, and I'm looking forward to working with you on helping the journal help to facilitate this integration. Dr. Brady, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
We are joined next by Dr. Patricia Conrad. Dr. Conrad is a clinical psychologist and professor of psychiatry at the University of Montreal. She is also the Dr. Julien Marcel and Jean Coutu Foundation Chair in Community Social Pediatrics. Projects in Dr. Conrad's research team focus on risk factors for substance misuse and mental health problems among adolescents. Her work looks at the interplay of cognitive, personality, and biological risk factors that affect drug abuse in the context of how they co-occur with mental disorders. She has also developed the Prevention Program, which has been identified as an evidence-based drug and alcohol prevention program. Hi, Dr. Conrad, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Now, your article investigated the link between year-to-year changes in substance use and cognitive development in a population of 7th grade students who were followed for 4 years. What did you and your co-authors find?
Right. So when we followed this cohort, which is a population-based cohort representing about 5% of all students who entered high school in the Greater Montreal area in that particular year, we followed them annually on substance use measures as well as computerized cognitive tests that allow us to assess their memory recall, their working memory, their perceptual reasoning, and their inhibitory control. And what we found was that there are a number of different ways in which alcohol and cannabis are related to these cognitive variables or cognitive functions. So first and foremost, substance use risk and low cognitive functioning are highly correlated and likely reflect some kind of underlying common vulnerability, meaning low levels of inhibitory control, memory recall, perceptual reasoning, working memory, before substance use even has had its onset, was related to the risk for being a heavier user during the adolescent period. But over and above that relationship, what we found was that if there was further increases in cannabis use in a given year, you saw additional impairments on a number of these cognitive functions. We also tested the extent to which substance use was related to impairment a year later, even after the substance use in that given year had returned to kind of baseline levels or a person's mean level of use. So if that uptick in substance use had returned to someone's baseline level of use, could you observe the effects of their use on future cognitive functioning? And so what we found was that there were quite a number of important and significant effects for adolescent cannabis use, particularly on working memory, on perception, delayed recall memory, and inhibitory control. And the most robust and lasting effects were on inhibitory control, which is a cognitive function that's involved in behavioral control, self-control, very much implicated in risk for addiction, and might actually reflect and explain why it is that early onset cannabis use or adolescent onset cannabis use is implicated in future risk for other addictive behaviors.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the inhibitory control, because I think one of the aspects that proponents of greater legalization, they always bring up, they kind of laugh away the gateway drug, that, you know, that marijuana really is safe, and it's, you know, they dispense with the idea that marijuana is a gateway drug. But you're kind of indicating that that cannabis use was associated with lasting effects of inhibitory control, which is a risk factor for additional addiction. So there is an element of that, isn't there?
Well, there's no demonstration of gateway using these data, because that was not the focus of,
sure.
of the study. But in the context of other studies suggesting that early onset cannabis use is linked to future risk, this might be one mechanism by which early onset use is mediating future risk. And there might be another of other variables, and it could also be that this could be explained through some other, you know, secondary variables or follow-on effects. So, for example, school performance or dropout resulting from the negative impacts of cannabis on cognitive functioning. But it's important to also discuss the limitations of this study. So obviously this is all observational data. It was all very highly quality controlled, both with respect to assessing substance use, but also with respecting cognitive functioning. But nevertheless, it is observed data. The only other way to demonstrate causality is to randomly assign young people to become users or to abstain from use, and obviously that is not an option when you're studying this phenomenon in human populations. So this is really the type of the design that most allows us to test hypotheses about causality, but they cannot confirm causality. It simply provides some effects that are consistent with a causal hypothesis that need to be further confirmed with pharmacological studies and cannabis administration studies with animal models, for example.
And what other aspects of your study are relevant for clinicians and other mental health professionals?
Well, I think that we should not underestimate the common vulnerability findings in this study. So first of all, that there were a number of cognitive factors that were shown to be related to risk for becoming an alcohol and cannabis user. There were a number of them that were common to both drugs. And these are variables that can be measured easily from the school context. They can also be modified somewhat using good educational and neuropsychological remediation interventions. So, you know, these are really important cognitive profiles that need to be addressed prior to the time at which the young person begins to get exposed to substances, because they appear to be linked or markers of risk. So that's, I think, the first point. The second point is that we didn't find any effects of alcohol on concurrent or future impairment on any of the cognitive domains. Now, that's not necessarily consistent with a very large body of literature that links quite severe cognitive deficits with heavy alcohol and chronic alcohol use and misuse. And so, you know, how can we reconcile our findings with this other literature? Well, I think the issue was is that we did not have very heavy drinkers in our adolescent sample. We also didn't have many students who were frequent drinkers. And so it could be that during the adolescent period, either young people are just not drinking at a level that's high enough to produce impairment in these cognitive domains, or that the adolescent brain might be really more resilient to the effects of alcohol, whereas the adult brain might be less resilient to the effects of alcohol. But in contrast, what we found for cannabis is that there, during the adolescent period, there really does appear to be some findings that require further investigation, indicating that young cannabis users are experiencing further cognitive impairment during the years and in years subsequent to the onset and increase in their cannabis use.
That's all very interesting, very interesting. And what's next for you in your research?
Well, we're investigating these effects, the individual and contextual factors that might moderate these effects. So to better understand who is most susceptible to the effects of cannabis on cognitive functioning. We're further investigating some of the potential mediators as well. And where else are we going with this? I guess the other big question is this study was these data came from a randomized trial. And we're about to break the blind on that trial and examine the effects of the intervention on alcohol and cannabis use. So the bigger question is, can a preventative intervention targeting alcohol and cannabis misuse actually protect cognitive development? And that was the primary objective of this study. So those primary outcomes are hopefully going to are going to be shared with the public over the next few months.
Ah, well, we very much look forward to that. Well, Dr. Conrad, I have to say, since we published your article back in October, I know it's gotten a lot of attention, a lot of discussion. So we very much appreciate you coming on to the podcast program to talk more about your study.
Thank you very much.
And that concludes this episode of AJP Audio. You can rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to it. Please also visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, to check out trending articles, find CME courses, and watch videos highlighting some of the research discussed in this episode, as well as some of our other articles. Be sure to check out another podcast from APA Publishing. From Pages to Practice reviews the latest research published in the journal Psychiatric Services. It's hosted by Dr. Lisa Dixon, editor-in-chief of the journal, along with Dr. Josh Barrison. You can find it at ps.psychiatryonline.org. You can also find it on Apple Podcasts or on the podcast page of the American Psychiatric Association's website. Next month in the podcast, we'll talk with Leah Richmond Rakert of Duke University about her article on adolescents who self-harm that tested early life predictors of those who would go on to commit violent crime against others. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.